From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This last year, really for the first time in a generation, you had a layer of prominent pro athletes speak out on issues of war, racism, and resistance. You had the NBA MVP Steve Nash come out against the war in Iraq. You had Major League slugger Carlos Delgado say that he wouldn't stand for God Bless America in protest of the bombings in Iraq and the defoliation of Vieques.
Today, a look at the history of sports and resistance. Dave Zirin, author of What's My Name, Fool? On Olympic Crackdown, Sports Segregation, and the Athletes Who Challenge Injustice. Then we look back on the imprisonment of Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti. He died 1 year ago today. But first to Haiti, as protesters in Brazil and 10 North American cities decry a UN raid on Cité Soleil earlier this month that may have left as many as 23 people dead. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. News reports out of Iraq say two Algerian diplomats in Baghdad have been kidnapped, among them the chief of the Algerian mission. This follows the abduction and killing earlier this month of Egypt's ambassador designate in Iraq. Meanwhile, there have been more suicide bombings in Iraq. There were two car bombings and a string of other attacks in and around Baghdad, killing 14 people. In one case, a car bomber rammed into an Iraqi army checkpoint south of Baghdad, killing five soldiers. A second Iraqi army checkpoint in a southern Baghdad suburb was also hit by a car bomber, killing one soldier. Several Iraqi officials were also killed yesterday in multiple attacks. Saudi Arabia's longtime ambassador in Washington, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, is resigning for what the Saudi foreign ministry says are private reasons. The man known as Bandar Bush, for his close ties to President Bush and his father, has been the ambassador to the U.S. for 22 years. He's enjoyed unprecedented White House access and influence in Washington circles. His father is Prince Sultan, the Saudi defense minister. Bandar's resignation coincides with uncertainty about the country's ruling hierarchy. King Fahd is seriously ill, and Prince Sultan could move up in any reshuffling of authority. Bandar himself has been rumored to be in line for a top security post in Riyadh. It now appears that Prince Turkiyar Faisal, another member of the Saudi royal family, will replace Bandar as ambassador. Prince Turki, like Bandar Bush, is leading member of the royal family and served as the head of Saudi intelligence for nearly a quarter of a century. Most recently, he was ambassador to London. His arrival in Washington is also likely to cause controversy. The prince was among several leading Saudi figures who were named in a $1 trillion lawsuit filed by the families of the victims of September 11th attacks, who claimed he helped to fund Osama bin Laden's network. And on at least five occasions, Prince Turki met personally with bin Laden and his lieutenants. He described bin Laden as very soft-spoken and, quote, quite a pleasant man. The Times of London reported in 2002 that before the 9/11 attacks, diplomatic sources said the Saudi government had come under intense pressure from Washington to replace Prince Turki as head of Saudi intelligence because of his past association and support for bin Laden. Supreme Court nominee John Roberts met with key senators from both parties yesterday as the White House rolled out a methodical campaign to secure his confirmation, and Democrats posed their first probing questions. Abortion and access to internal government memos loomed as likely flashpoints as Democrats point toward the nationally televised proceedings. Meanwhile, civil liberties and women's rights groups continue to protest against Roberts' nomination. Last night in New York, Planned Parenthood and the National Abortion Rights Action League held a rally. This is New York City Councilperson Margarita Lopez.
My reproductive system is mine and mine only. It doesn't belong to nobody else except me. I decide what happened with it, what do I do with it, and it's mine to take care of it. Whatever I do is between me and my doctor. When I had to make decisions about it. George Walker Bush, keep your filthy hands out of my body.
New York City Councilmember Margarita Lopez speaking on Wednesday in Union Square, New York. Now to the Karl Rove CIA scandal. The Washington Post is reporting a classified State Department memo central to the federal investigation into who leaked Valerie Plame's name as an undercover CIA operative contained information about her in a paragraph marked S for secret. The Post calls it a clear indication that any Bush administration official who read it should have been aware the information was classified. In the memo, Plame is referred to by her married name, Valerie Wilson. Almost all the memo is devoted to describing why State Department intelligence experts did not believe claims that Saddam Hussein had in the past sought to purchase uranium from Niger, as Plame's husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, asserted after his fact-finding mission to the African nation. The memo was delivered to Secretary of State Colin Powell on July 7, 2003, as he headed to Africa for a trip with President Bush aboard Air Force One. Plame was unmasked in a syndicated column by Robert Novak 7 days later. Prosecutors are reviewing the phone records from that trip and have questioned several of Bush's staffers who were on the trip. Meanwhile, 11 former intelligence officers have written an open letter to congressional leaders saying the outing of Plame as a CIA operative may have damaged national security and the government's ability to gather intelligence. They blasted the Republican National Committee for circulating talking points about the scandal that alleged Plame was not really working undercover because she worked at a desk in Langley and legally merited no protection. The 11 point out that thousands of U.S. intelligence officers work at desks in Washington area every day whose identities are shielded, as Plame's was when her identity was leaked. An Italian prosecutor asked an appeals court Wednesday to issue arrest warrants for six more purported CIA operatives, accusing them of helping plan the kidnapping of an Egyptian Muslim cleric in 2003. An Italian court issued warrants for 13 alleged CIA officers last month, but turned down a request by prosecutor Armando Spaltero to issue warrants for six Americans accused of helping prepare the abduction of Osama Mustafa Hassan Nasser. According to the AP, the prosecutor's request says the six were involved in studying the area in Milan where the cleric was seized and his habits, as well as the best routes to the highway the kidnappers would use to bring the Egyptian to Aviano, a joint U.S.-Italian airbase north of Venice. Nasser was allegedly snatched on a Milan street on February 17, 2003, flown from Aviano to Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and then to Egypt, where he reportedly was tortured. The operation was allegedly part of the CIA's, quote, extraordinary rendition program, in which terror suspects are transferred to third countries without court approval, subjecting them to possible torture. The mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, said yesterday that Western foreign policy has fueled the Islamist radicalism behind the July 7th London bomb attacks. In an interview with the BBC Wednesday, Livingstone said, quote, "You've just had 80 years of Western intervention into predominantly Arab lands because of a Western need for oil. We've propped up unsavory governments. We've overthrown ones that we didn't consider sympathetic." Livingstone continued, quote, "I think the particular problem we have at the moment is that in the 80s, the Americans recruited and trained Osama bin Laden, taught him how to kill, to make bombs, and set him off to kill the Russians to drive them out of Afghanistan. They didn't give any thought to the fact that once he'd done that, he might turn on his creators." The London mayor, Livingstone, also blasted the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo. An opinion poll this week showed two-thirds of Brits see a connection between the Iraq occupation and the bombings. Meanwhile, the man known as Osama bin Laden's ambassador in Europe, Abu Qatada, is facing deportation to Jordan after British officials brokered a potentially groundbreaking extradition deal. Qatada is a Jordanian national and is wanted by eight police forces across three continents. He's currently under house arrest in London. Under English law, a foreign national can't be deported if he faces the risk of mistreatment or death sentence. Human rights groups have raised concern about what they fear may become a pattern of Britain deporting Muslims that criticize British policy. emergency protests will take place in cities across the United States today, as well as Brazil, to condemn the massacre of what might be 23 Haitian civilians on July 6th in the neighborhood of Cité Soleil by UN troops under Brazilian command. The protest organizers are calling for UN troops and Haitian authorities to stop the killings, for all UN soldiers from 20 nations to leave Haiti now, and for the restoration of Haiti's sovereignty and constitutional rule. We'll have more on this in just a minute. Two Afghans released from the Guantanamo prison are alleging that about 180 Afghans at the prison camp are on hunger strike to protest alleged abuse and to push for freedom. They estimate the men are in the 14th or 15th day of that fast. A Washington-based lawyer for 12 detainees from Kuwait said several prisoners told him during a visit in Guantanamo in late June that there was a widespread hunger strike over the amount and quality of their drinking water. And finally, Canada has legalized gay marriage, becoming the world's fourth nation to grant full legal rights to same-sex couples. The Netherlands, Belgium, and Spain are the only other nations that have legalized gay marriage nationwide. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We go first to Haiti, where violence continues to rack the capital of Port-au-Prince. More than 700 people have been killed since September. Today, a coordinated day of protest is planned to condemn the July 6 UN raid on Cité Soleil, a neighborhood of Port-au-Prince, which may have left as many as 23 Haitian civilians dead. The protests in Brazil and 10 North American cities follow a demonstration by more than 5,000 people in Cité Soleil last week. Also this week, prominent political leader Father Gerard Jean-Just was detained by Haitian police, falsely accused of bringing weapons, bombs, and money for mercenaries back to Haiti from Miami. Father Jean-Just is a prominent leader in ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's Lavalas party. Lavalas is calling for a boycott of upcoming elections unless Aristide is allowed to return from exile in South Africa. This comes as a U.S.-backed advisory council that oversees Haiti's interim government recommended Saturday that Lavalas be barred from upcoming elections, accusing the party of encouraging violence. And last week, journalist Jacques Roche, cultural editor with the Daily Le Matin, was kidnapped and murdered. Some are pinning the murder on Lavalas forces. We're joined now on the phone by Father Gerard Jean-Just. He's attending the funeral of Jacques Roche. Also on the line, Bill Quigley, a volunteer attorney with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And next in the broadcast, we are going to be speaking with David Zirin. He has written the book What's My Name, Fool, Sports and Resistance in the United States, and we'll remember Farouk Abdelmouti, a Palestinian activist who died a year ago today. We turn now to Port-au-Prince, to Father Jean-Just on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Emmy. Good morning to you. Good morning to everyone. And as you said, I am in Port-au-Prince, in the middle of trouble, but with the help of God, we are surviving and providing as many services as possible to our people. Yeah.
Father Jean-Just, can you describe what happened to you when you returned to Haiti last Friday?
There was a radio station in Miami where somebody has rented an hour on the radio program, on the radio. And then they were accusing me falsely, saying that I'm transporting arms, bombs, and ammunition, and also big sum of money to Haiti. And as I arrived at the airport, about to board the plane, they call upon me, and then I saw three agents who came and demanded that I be searched, and so that they stopped me. And as I'm talking to you, I said in this question, I'm driving, and the police is hauling me, and so it's a little difficult. Okay, so they stopped me, they searched totally, and they searched my bag that was already on the plane, and then they let the plane leave for Haiti. And arriving in Haiti that Friday, the 15th of July, arriving in Haiti by 1:30 finally, and I found security posted everywhere. And then I went to custom again, Haitian custom, and they searched all my luggages, everything. And after I went through all the search, as I was stepping out to take my to go home, and then a policeman approached me and said that they want me to come with them. So want me to come. They want me at the police station by the airport. So that's where I went. Yeah, that's where I went. And I stayed to, I think it was about 4 o'clock, and I left there by 6 o'clock. They wanted to question me about many things. And then finally I said to them, hey, listen, I have a service at 4:30, and I have another one at 7:30, and I'm not going to answer any question today after I identify myself and said everything about where I'm coming from. But any question regarding any child, I'm not going to answer anything. And then they understand that I was not going to talk, and they called the chief, and the chief asked them to make me fill the form that I'm not going to answer, and they could take another appointment with me. And so that's what was done, and they let me go home by 6. And then I returned to the police station, but this time the headquarters, called DCPJ, Central Direction for the Judiciary Police. And they make me wait from 10 o'clock to 11:30 in a hot room with bright lights on my head. We are 4 in the room with one chair. And by 11:30, the chief came and said, hey, we don't have any question for you right now. You go home, and then write you when we need you again. And so that was it. And meanwhile, I got a warning from a judge to be present at the court Wednesday, July 20. So that was it. So I went to the court yesterday. They interviewed me for about 2 hours. From 9:30 to 11:30, and the judge took all the instructions and let me go. And he said, be ready. Whenever they need me, they will call upon me again. So this is where I am. Everybody wanted a piece of me and keeping me harassed. And then I'm persecuted, and threats coming from all over. And meanwhile, I've been very busy helping the kids in my neighborhood have a nice summer, thanks to many friends who have helped me about that. So right now, today, I am on my way to attend the funeral of Jack Walsh, a prominent journalist who have been kidnapped and killed. And I'm going to show myself because his parents are from my town. And at the certain time, one of his relatives has saved my life. I was being attacked by a mob. And then Mrs. Walsh came out strongly and get me off the gangs and sheltered me at her house. So this is the reason why I feel that I should be there, regardless that they keep accusing the Rahala's people of participating in the killing. And none of us, and no Rahala's, has been participating in my point of view. So what's going on now? We become the scapegoat. Whatever happened in this country, they put it on the back of Rahala's. And so this is a wrong thinking, because it's very dangerous. They want to get rid of Rahala's, and for anything, they blame Rahala's. So I think enough is enough. If we want peace in this country, if we want to return to democracy, it's not the way for the official to operate. They should let the justice system make its way, and by going through investigation, find the proper criminal element and then bring the criminal element to justice. Recently, there was a kidnapping. They found a guy, about a light-skinned guy who was involved, and they didn't even let us see his face. They covered his face at the airport, and we only see the white feet at the television. And then so far we have no instruction on the on this accused person. So that's the way it is. There are some people, they are being aimed at, they are being persecuted, they are being targeted, and others, regardless that they caught them in the pudding, and they try to protect them. So this is a double standard, and we wish that this persecution of Lavalas could stop the sooner the better and bring the constitutional, let's return to constitutional order, because in my point of view, the president, the de facto president, Boniface, the de facto prime minister, General Atatu, they are all criminals, because they have been taking the power with violence and with the support of a sector of within the international community, with the asylum, killing police, destroying institutional goods, destroying the state goods, a state institution in order to get another power. They are all criminals. They are the ones who should be brought to justice and free all the political prisoners, particularly the legal prime minister, Yvonne Netsin.
Father Jean-Just, I want to thank you for being with us. One last quick question. Today, there are protests in a number of cities in North America, from Brazil to the United States to Canada, for the killings in Cité Soleil last week. On Democracy Now!, we had a report about the UN troops moving in. What is the aftermath, and are there protests today in Haiti?
We protested yesterday, and today, as the funeral is taking place, I think the funeral will take the lead. And in honor of John Bush, we're not going to protest in the street today. And but there will be a protest today organized by the journalists instead. So we are in very great support, and we are very grateful to all the friends, Haitian American, and all the other friends of Haitians in U.S., in Canada, in Brazil, who are demonstrating last Thursday. That was one of key demonstrations that we had at the consulate, at the Brazilian consulate in Miami, since after persecution has increased for me. But this is our right to peacefully demonstrate, and wherever we are, we're going to keep exercise that right. And I hope everything we go find for our brothers and sisters who are peacefully demonstrating in the world. And then the message should be clear. We won't accept massacre from any troops in Haiti, in police, or from the international troops. We won't accept massacre. They keep massacring the poorest Haitians, and we say no, we should massacre nobody. So in that sense, we appreciate very much the pickets and the demonstration organized all over the U.S. and Canada and Brazil.
Thank you very much, Father Jean-Just, a Catholic priest in Haiti who was recently detained by Haitian forces. He had been in prison for months without charge. Now talking on this day where there is protests throughout North America on the killing of Cité Soleil residents by UN troops. Father Jean-Just speaking to us from the streets of Port-au-Prince, where he said he is driving and being followed now by police. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll speak with a sports writer about race and resistance. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And our headlines are in Spanish, audio and transcript at our website. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks after the London bombings that left over 50 people dead and hundreds wounded, London's mayor, Ken Livingstone, is blaming Western foreign policy as motivating the attackers and giving rise to Muslim extremism. In an interview with the BBC News on Wednesday, Livingstone said, quote, "If at the end of the First World War we'd done what we promised the Arabs, which was to let them be free and have their own governments and kept out of Arab affairs and just bought their oil rather than feeling we had to control the flow of oil, I suspect this wouldn't have arisen." Livingstone also referred to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Guantanamo Bay, and policies of foreign occupation as fueling extremism. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Tony Blair is preparing to hold talks with police and intelligence chiefs to establish what further powers they need in the wake of the attacks. Home Secretary Charles Clarke told British MPs of plans to set up a global database of extremists who face automatic vetting before being allowed into the country. The database would list, quote, "unacceptable behavior, such as radical preaching, websites, and writing articles intended to foment terrorism." Clarke also said Britain had reached an agreement with Jordan, which would enable Britain to deport Jordanian nationals suspected of inciting or supporting terrorism. Under international convention, the British government cannot send people back to a country where they might face mistreatment or death penalty. This new agreement removes this bar to deportations. While the aftermath of the London bombings continue to be front page news around the world, few people remember that just one day earlier, London won a closely fought bid to host the 2012 Olympics. According to our next guest, history shows that bringing the Olympics to a city also brings the utter immiseration of civil liberties. We're joined now in our studio by sports writer David Zirin. His new book is called "What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States." We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Let's talk about that history of Olympics past.
Well, the starting point is understanding that sports is a $1 trillion business worldwide, and the Olympics is like the ultimate prize. I mean, for the people who run a city, when they make their Olympic bids, getting the Olympics is like Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, all rolled up into one for these guys. And when London got the Olympics for 2012, when they won that bid in a huge surprise over Paris, they were celebrating in the streets of London, particularly in the boardrooms and the banks. But also people in London wept when that occurred, because people in London had already started organizing about what they understand the Olympics coming to mean. Now, part of the reason why people have this idea about what it means for the Olympics come to a given town is because of the history that does exist. I mean, when the Olympics come to an area, it may mean a corporate feeding frenzy, but what it also means is it means, as you put it, the utter immiseration of civil liberties, as well as attacks on working people and the poor. And history really does prove this out. I mean, I'll just give some of the lowlights here. In 1936, this was probably one of the most infamous ones, when the Olympics were awarded to Berlin, even though it was known at the time the extent of Hitler's crimes and the crimes of the Nazis. There was a cleansing of the streets of Berlin, as it was put, to make the city look hospitable, as if Germany had emerged from the Depression. And that, of course, meant locking up dissidents, sending people to concentration camps. In 1968, in Mexico City, there was the infamous massacre of 500 workers and students by Mexican security forces as they attempted to make their city, quote unquote, hospitable for an international audience. In 1984, in this country, it's not just other countries by any stretch of the imagination, in 84 there were the infamous gang sweeps in Los Angeles, which involved people in the LA City Council reviving the 1916 Anti-Syndicalism Act, which was used in 1916 to go after the industrial workers of the world, which was a radical union at the time. And part of what this law said was that it outlawed certain hand signals and modes of dress that sort of denoted somebody as being in the IWW, and they just applied that to young black men in LA. So if you were wearing certain colors or gave people a certain kind of high five, it was grounds to arrest people in 1984 in LA. And those gang sweeps were immortalized in the NWA video Straight Outta Compton, which was like a reenactment of the 84 gang sweeps, which people, you know, should check out. It's interesting. In 1996 in Atlanta, keep it in this country, you had, according to the ACLU, 10,000 black homeless men arrested without cause. And you had a scandalous situation that they swept under the rug where police were found to fill out arrest slips in advance of arresting people of, you know, black, male. You know, they had those filled out going into the streets to make Atlanta, you know, ironically, this image of the New South that President Clinton attempted to project at the 96 Olympics. But in 2004, in Athens, I think we all saw it go to another level. Athens was the first post-9/11 Olympics, and what we saw there was something that you even hadn't seen in years past, and that was the presence of 50,000 paramilitary forces, not from Greece, but from the United States, Great Britain, and Israel. And their presence was actually in violation of the Greek Constitution, but it was welcomed by the Greek Prime Minister at the time because of that pressure to make Greece, quote unquote, hospitable for an international audience. And that meant the mass arrest of thousands of ordinary people in Greece. And so I think there's an awareness about what the Olympics bring, not to mention about the fact that they tend to suck municipalities dry of funds, which is why, interestingly, New York City, as you may know, was in the finals to get the Olympics. And something that ESPN Radio reported with surprise and shock was that ESPN was being flooded with emails by people from New York, New Jersey area saying, please don't send the Olympics here. We don't want them in New York City. We don't want this stadium. And ESPN, you know, which is of course about promoting all things sports, you know, working people be damned, was absolutely flummoxed by this. Like, wow, people don't want the Olympics in New York City. And they were just scratching their heads. But if they looked at history, they would see why.
We're talking to David Zirin. He's a sports writer, and his book is called What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. Why the title?
What's My Name, Fool? First, to be very clear, it's not a tribute to Mr. T. That was asked to me at one book reading. That would be Pity the Fool. No. What's My Name, Fool? It's a reference to really what the heart of the book is about. The book is about the intersection of radical politics and pro sports, about times when movements off the field found expression on the playing field. And to me, the high point of that history was the time when the heavyweight champion of the world had one foot in the black freedom struggle and one foot in the anti-war movement. And of course, I'm talking about Muhammad Ali. Now, when Ali changed his name, first from Cassius Clay, and then to Cassius X, which a lot of people don't know, he was shortly known as Cassius X, and then to Muhammad Ali, when he did this, there's just no words for the firestorm that this caused, because, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world, that's supposed to be a symbol of all that's Americana, a symbol of, you know, masculinity and standing for the flag. And you had the heavyweight champion of the world join the organization of Malcolm X, join an organization in the Nation of Islam that believed in self-defense against racist attacks. And I was trying to relay to an audience today about the firestorm that this caused. And the only thing I could think of is, you have to imagine if, say, Jenna Bush joined the Iraqi resistance. I mean, that would be the only way you could make a comparison to when Ali joined the Nation of Islam and forced people to confront that name change. Now, overnight, whether you called the champion Clay or Ali, it said everything about you in the 1960s. It said what side you were on in the black freedom struggle, what side you were on in the free speech fights on college campuses, soon the war in Vietnam. And therefore, Ali's fights, they had this incredible morality plays they became. You know, if the champion won, it wasn't just about an individual winning a sporting event. It was about the confidence of a new and rising movement in a way that people took very personally and very seriously. Now, you go to the title, What's My Name, Fool? Goes to when this name change controversy really was at its apex. And that's in November 1965, when Ali fought a former two-time champion named Floyd Patterson. And in the lead up to the fight, this is what Patterson said. He said, I am fighting Clay, and yes, his name is Clay, as a crusade to return the title to America and take it from the black Muslims. Now, Ali's response to this was really interesting because he had no response. This was one of the most loquacious athletes ever. You know, the press called him the Louisville Lip and Gaseous Cassius because he liked to talk so much. But he didn't say anything in the lead up to the fight. And actually, in the fight itself, he let his fighting do the talking. Observers say he could have knocked out Patterson in one round, but actually, he drew it out over 9 rounds. Sports writer Robert Lipsight described it as watching someone pick the wings off a butterfly. And as Ali peppered Patterson with jabs, what he said, and he said it in a loud, clear voice so all of press row could hear, he said, "Come on, America. Come on, white America. Say my name. What's my name, fool?" And that's where I got the title of the book. And that's just the title. So we got a lot in this book.
Well, this is an excerpt of the remarkable film, When We Were Kings, the documentary about Muhammad Ali's 1974 championship bout with George Foreman in Kinshasa, that came to be known as The Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah, I'm in Africa. Yeah, Africa's my home. Damn America and what America thinks. Yeah, I live in America, but Africa's the home of the black man, and I was a slave 400 years ago, and I'm going back home to fight among my brothers.
That a clip from When We Were Kings, Muhammad Ali. You talk about Muhammad Ali being, at that time, extremely political, outspoken, yet today young people might not know that at all, though Muhammad Ali is the most famous name in the world.
Yes. I mean, today Muhammad Ali's image is used to sell everything from Sprite to Microsoft with the benefit of computer CGI. And there's no question that what's happened to Muhammad Ali, you know, is not dissimilar to what's happened to people like Malcolm X, who's now on a postage stamp, or Martin Luther King, whose image you can now get on a commemorative cup when you go into McDonald's on his birthday. And that Muhammad Ali's political teeth have largely been extracted. And that's something that, with this book, I want to hope to return to the arena, is like the context of Ali's politics, because the tradition of Ali and that tradition of resistance is something that's, I think, very important for people to know. I mean, Ali was just named the number two most important athlete in history in ESPN's top 100 athletes of all time. But when you saw their tribute to him, I mean, you would have left wondering, okay, well, what's so special about this guy? And that's why it's so important to return to the arena as we understand sports, that dynamic relationship between struggles on the streets, how it affected athletes, but then also how athletes then in turn affected those struggles.
Let's go back to another clip of When We Were Kings. Muhammad Ali was an anti-war, was known as an anti-war symbol to some. This is a news clip from that film.
Cassius Clay, at a federal court in Houston, is found guilty of violating the U.S. Selective Service laws by refusing to be inducted. He is sentenced to 5 years in prison and fined $10,000.
What happened to Muhammad Ali then?
Well, Muhammad Ali was stripped of his title, and he was forced to report to a draft board in El Paso, Texas. Now, this is very interesting because, you know, Ali was offered the same deal that many past heavyweight champions had been offered, which was, you know, that he could just, you know, it's not like he was going to be sent to, you know, to Saigon or anything. He could have worn red, white, and blue trunks, boxed at some USO shows, and kept the title. But instead, what Ali said was, he was quite clear. He said, "The enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace my people, my religion, or myself by fighting against other people," speaking about the National Liberation Front in Vietnam, "who are fighting for their own freedom, justice, and liberty." And so he came out very, there was no mistaking where he stood on this. So they stripped him of his title for his anti-war views, and he was sent down to the draft office there. And as he went down there, it wasn't known exactly what Ali was going to do when he got there, because he was facing a prison sentence of 5 years, you know, in a federal prison. So there was actually a rally outside the El Paso area that was organized by both H-Rap Brown and the students at Texas Western, now Texas El Paso. And they were out there, a couple hundred of them, with a huge banner, and what it said was, "Draft beer, not Ali." And when Ali went in there, and when they called his name to take the step forward, I don't know if this made a difference, but they made quite a mistake when they called his name, and that they called for Cassius Clay to take a step forward, and he absolutely refused. Then they asked for Muhammad Ali to take a step forward, and he absolutely refused. And there's a tremendous quote by a writer named Gerald Early, who said that when Ali refused to take that step forward, I felt more than pride in him. I felt as if my honor as a young black boy had been defended. He was the dragon slayer. And I went home into my room that night and I cried. I cried for myself and I cried for our black possibilities. I mean, that's just the power that that moment had for people was incalculable, but not something that's talked about when ESPN, you know, Classic does a look at Muhammad Ali.
Wasn't there a tradition of black Muslim resistance to war, Elijah Muhammad being a war resister in World War II?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about Ali, though, was that nexus of him also being the heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, the tradition of athletes going to war could, you know, is its own book in and of itself. And while there are some famous athletes, you know, Ted Williams comes to mind, who actually flew missions in the theater of war, more often than not, it was a ceremonial role. It was something that you did before the cameras to be on the newsreels before, you know, that the film started. It was a way for you to show that, you know, you're patriotic duty or whatnot. And Ali just gave the stiff arm to all of that stuff. He wanted no part of it. And there's this great clip of him in another documentary where he's just walking down the hall and he's saying, like, I will not compromise myself for the white man's money. And he's screaming this at the camera. And that's really where Ali stood. And it's worth saying that now it's like we talk about this. And, I, you know, obviously I'm greatly taken with his political stance in the 60s. But at the time, he was an absolutely reviled figure in the mainstream press. I mean, he was torn apart. He was popular on the left and on college campuses in the black community. But in terms of like the media culture at the time, sometimes we speak about the media today as if it's this corporate monolith, as if in the past it was somehow this arena of debate and discussion. But back then, oh my goodness, there was no Democracy Now back then. You know, he was absolutely destroyed. And if I could, I'd like to read a brief section of what sports writer Jimmy Cannon, who is by far the most famous sports writer of the era, what he wrote about Ali. And you got to think that Jimmy Cannon is like Mike Lupica on steroids. I mean, he was huge. This is what he wrote about Ali. He wrote, Clay, of course he calls him Clay. Clay fits in with the famous singers no one can hear and the punks riding motorcycles and Batman. I don't understand the Batman part. And the boys with their long, dirty hair and the girls with the unwashed look, and the college kids dancing naked at secret proms, and the revolt of students who get a check from dad, and the painters who copy the labels off soup cans, and surf bums who refuse to work, and the whole pampered cult of the bored young. I mean, my goodness, if I read that, you'd think the Unabomber wrote that. It's this insane rant. But this was the most famous sports writer in the United States, basically laying it down that Muhammad Ali was somehow less than a human being because he stood up to this war.
We're talking to David Zirin. What's my name, fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States is the title of his book. When we come back, I want to ask you about Jackie Robinson, about the Williams sisters. I also want to ask you about Pat Tillman. I want to talk also about resistance today of sports athletes. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Dave Zirin, sports writer, author of What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, Pat Tillman.
Pat Tillman. Pat Tillman was a man who was an overachiever as a football player. He went out of college undrafted. He went on to become an all-pro playing for the Arizona Cardinals. And as is well known, he left after 9/11, turned down a multi-million dollar contract to join the Army Rangers with his brother to fight in Afghanistan and eventually in Iraq, although at the time he thought he was just fighting in Afghanistan. Now, the Tillman story is a tragic one for many reasons, and I'd like to go through it a little bit. First and foremost, Pat Tillman was asked hundreds, thousands of times, according to his parents, to be a recruiter for the Army, to go in commercials about join the Army, Army of One, Pat Tillman. They wanted to put his name on posters everywhere, and Tillman refused. Why did Tillman refuse? We don't know. Because, I mean, he was very iconoclastic. He was known to have hair down. It was behind. He did cliff diving, all kinds of stuff. He never came out and said, I'm going to go over there and occupy and kill and all this stuff. He kept his reasons to himself about why he was doing what he was doing. And that actually frustrated people in the Justice Department, I mean, in the Pentagon. They wanted to use this guy, and they weren't able to do it. And there are quotes about that, about their sort of frustration about that. Pat Tillman, of course, died. He died in Afghanistan. He was shot and killed. At the time, we were told that he died in the process of attempting to find bin Laden and to take a hill in the caves of Afghanistan. Now, there's a tragic element to this, of course. When Tillman died, there was a nationally televised funeral that John McCain spoke at, as well as other politicians from Arizona. George W. Bush, during the election campaign, actually addressed the fans at the Arizona Cardinals game through the Jumbotron to tell them about the heroism of Pat Tillman in attempting to take this hill. There was only one problem with this scenario, and that's that it was a total, absolute lie. What happened to Pat Tillman was that he was killed by his own troops. You read reports of the incident. I mean, it's almost like a metaphor for the whole war. It's insane. I mean, their Humvee broke down. A section of them broke off to circle around and look for help or whatnot, and they ended up circling around and firing at each other. And Pat Tillman died. Now, what's so disgusting about this is that the Pentagon knew immediately that this had occurred, but they kept that information secret, not only from the media, not only from Pat Tillman's parents, but also from his brother, who was in the same battalion as him and was somewhere else at that time. They even kept the information from him. And I mean, it boggles the mind. Now, what's important about this to say is that there's a lot of, I mean, these aren't conspiracy theories, but Pat Tillman's death happened at the same time that the photos around Abu Ghraib were released. And it's definitely thought now by Pat Tillman's parents that the reason why they hid the information was because they needed a PR boost in the wake of Abu Ghraib. And Pat and Mary Tillman, Pat Sr., his father, have come out since then strongly and publicly against the Bush administration and against the lies that led, to the lying about their son. They rightly are called this an obscenity. They were used as props at their own son's funeral. And so it's like, what did Pat Tillman die for? He died for PR for this war. And that, I mean, I can't imagine being Pat or Mary Tillman, but they're very private people, and they're coming forward and speaking out. And to that, they deserve all of our support in that process.
David Zirin, I wanted to end by asking you about Jackie Robinson, another very well-known sports figure.
Yes. I'd like to read a quote about Jackie Robinson, if I could, by Dr. Martin Luther King. Jackie Robinson was a political person. First of all, let's go with myth and reality about Jackie Robinson, very briefly. Jackie Robinson, the myth was that he was sort of like the quiet person who suffered in silence. Jackie Robinson once said, people see me as sort of the suffering freak black saint. The person who never talks, has nothing to say. But in reality, Jackie Robinson was a very political person. He had a sports column in the New York Post, which was then a liberal publication. He wrote about issues like civil rights a great deal. His politics were very complicated. He was a Republican, but that was because his family was chased out of Georgia by the Democrat Dixiecrats at a young age. And in his mind, his whole life, he saw the Democrats as being connected with segregation and Dixie. But just when I read this quote, like, a lot of people criticize Robinson for being political. And this is Dr. Martin Luther King in defense of him. He said, "Jackie Robinson has the right to be political because back in the days when integration wasn't fashionable, he underwent the trauma and the humiliation and the loneliness which comes with being a pilgrim that walks in the lonesome byways toward the high road of freedom. He was a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides." And I think that nails it very well. Jackie Robinson and this Brooklyn Dodgers team, and I write about this in the book, were in some respects a stalking horse for the whole civil rights movement. In the late 40s and early 50s, before Brown versus Board of Ed, before Montgomery, they're going around and playing games in stadiums that are segregated throughout the South. You know, the Klan is threatening, you know, that they're going to shoot all the players if Jackie Robinson takes the field. And the players, largely who were from the South, stood with Jackie Robinson in this process. And in the book, I interview a person who was at a lot of these games who's still alive, a sports writer named Lester Red Rodney. And Lester Rodney, he has the most amazing stories about fans, white fans in the South, starting to cheer for Robinson at the end of games. And this idea of seeing black and white play together on the field is why Roy Campanella once said, he said, "Hey, Brown versus Board of Ed." Oh, Roy Campanella was the African-American catcher of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Roy Campanella said, "Brown versus Board of Ed gets all the credit. But we were doing Brown and Board versus Board of Ed on the playing field before the Supreme Court ever heard about it." You know, and that's what he said. And someone laughed and he said, "What, you think I'm joking?"
Talk about Jackie Robinson's history. You talk about how he was a Republican, that he thought, yes, the Democrats represented segregation. What it meant for him to be a player, how he was seen, the McCarthy era, yes, and then his relationship with Nixon and with, yes, Martin Luther King.
Well, it's complicated, definitely. I mean, Jackie Robinson was somebody who was never shy about expressing his political views. He was deeply political, deeply articulate, but he also was somebody who was a bit of a political cipher. He bounced around a lot between different views and opinions. In the late 1940s, during McCarthyism, Jackie Robinson had been so successful in integrating Major League Baseball that he was listed as the number two respected American in the United States behind Harry Truman in the late 1940s, despite the fact that he received thousands of death threats throughout the season. Now, in 1949, Robinson was asked to actually speak at the House of Un-American Activities Committee in condemnation of the great activist, singer, actor, and actually former great athlete, Paul Robeson. And it was Robeson, just before Robinson came out there, had famously just taken the heads off of the House of the Un-American Activities Committee. I mean, the most blistering speech, where they basically told Robeson to go back to Russia, and Robeson said, "You know, my family built this country from the bottom up, and no fascist-minded individuals like you are going to tell me what I can or can't do." And this was really the first time that HUAC was punctured, you know, because before that there was a lot of, you know, "I take the fifth," and people remaining mum in the face of their intimidation and their might. So they called up Branch Rickey, who was a staunch anti-communist. Branch Rickey was the general manager and part owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And they said, "We need Robinson in here to condemn Robeson." And Rickey actually wasn't wild about doing it. And the NAACP offered to defend Robinson, to say, "You don't have to go in there and speak against Robeson." But it has to be said that Robinson wanted to do it. And once again, you get into a lot of conflicting views about why. And I mean, the fact that Robinson did it, I would say, is unforgivable. It's a reason why a lot of activists in the 1960s, like Malcolm X, they pretty much tore Robinson up. Like Malcolm X once said, Cassius Clay, this was before the name change. Malcolm X said, "Cassius Clay is our hero. He's the first real black sports hero. Jackie Robinson is a white man's hero." And he said that because of the Robeson incident. But what Robinson did, if you read the whole transcript, I mean, he came there and the speech is incredible. Like, he spoke out against HUAC too. He basically said, "Don't tell me about communism. Don't tell me about any of this stuff, because communism isn't the reason that dogs are being sicked on us in the South. Communism isn't what's burning black churches." You know, so he has this speech where basically he lays out to HUAC that racism is about America, not about agitators stirring people people up. But then at the same time, he did take a shot at Robeson, saying that that his people, that he basically speaking for all African Americans, said are not going to give up our dreams of equality, as he put it, for a siren song sung in bass. And that's a famous quote, you know, because Paul Robeson had that famous basso profundo voice. And I mean, the tragedy of that was that the HUAC people and the media as well could not care less about Robinson's eloquence about racism. They could not care less. What they did was they took the slap at Robeson and ran with it. And that was the headline in the papers the next day. Robinson smacks down Robeson was basically the headline. And that led to Robeson's, it was a factor in Robeson's political isolation. And it's worth saying that Robeson was approached for a response to Robinson, and he refused to do it. And he said, I refuse to be part of this kind of interscene feud with Jackie Robinson.
And yet Robinson wrote in his memoir he was sorry he spoke
deeply out. Deeply sorry, his greatest regret.
When Martin Luther King went to jail?
Ooh, when Martin Luther King went to jail.
Jackie Robinson's response?
Yeah, Jackie Robinson came out strongly against it. I mean, Jackie Robinson had a very interesting relationship with Martin Luther King. That's very interesting. Because Jackie Robinson, you read his writings on the time, he's always in support of Martin Luther King, always in support of everything King does, except on two questions that are very interesting. One question where he differs with Martin Luther King is on the question of violence and nonviolence. I mean, after one of the church burnings where four young African-American girls were killed, Jackie Robinson wrote a column once again in the New York Post, and you always have to shake your head when you think of this stuff actually in the New York Post because of the rag that it is today. But Robinson wrote that he said, Martin Luther King has officially lost me to his credo of nonviolence. Said, because we cannot respond nonviolently when our children are being killed. The other instance where they differed, and this is to me very fascinating, is, you know, Jackie Robinson was a veteran. So when Martin Luther King Jr. came out against the war in Vietnam, Jackie Robinson wrote that it was a tragic mistake on behalf of King. And King actually called him up on the phone, and they had like a two-hour conversation on the phone. And when it was done, what Robinson said was, he said, look, I may not agree with Dr. King on this question, but I will never speak out against him again on this issue.
And he appealed to Nixon. And
Nixon,
I mean, asked him to, we only have 30 seconds, but asked him to release Martin Luther King.
Yeah, yes, he did. Yes, he did. I mean, the Nixon relationship is a complicated one. At the end of his life, Jackie Robinson was not a Nixon fan, as when he saw Nixon pursue the Southern strategy in 68. But the important thing to remember about Jackie Robinson, I'll end with this point, is not to look at him for sort of a political lead, because he's all over the place politically. The point is that he represents part of a very real tradition of athletes having more than just bodies and brawn and sweat, but them having minds as well. Athletes are part of our world. They have a relationship with our world, and it's important for us to engage with them as we would engage with anybody, as people with thoughts, ideas, dreams, and maybe even fighters alongside with us in the move towards a more just society.
David Zirin, I want to thank you for being with us. So this is just part one of our conversation, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. As we wrap up the show, we go to a live webcam in London. Scotland Yard says emergency service workers are responding to, quote, incidents at three London underground subway stations. Scotland Yard told CNN one incident was also reported on a bus in Hackney in East London. Meanwhile, a nail bomb exploded at London's Warren Street underground station, a source at a city transport company told Reuters news agency no casualties have been reported. Again, this just coming out of Britain right now, talking about explosions or incidents. Passengers are reporting smoke coming out of the subway station. And that does it for today's broadcast. Tomorrow, we will remember Farouk Abdelmouti, who died 1 year ago today, a Palestinian activist. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salome. We'll also thank Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get transcripts and podcasting and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!